Britain's Ken Follett is one of the world's best-selling writers of 180 million books and counting across quite different genres. Six of his 36 novels have been made into films, like The Eye of the Needle, most famously, and there have been war stories, spy novels, medieval sagas like the Pillars of the Earth trilogy. His new book's been described as compelling and only too realistic by Larry Summers, the former US Treasury Secretary. The President of the United States in it is a woman, but North Korea and China have leaders pretty similar to the ones they have at present. Events in Korea and the South China Sea pass a possible point of no return as politicians and operatives on both sides clamour for a war that may graduate to a nuclear holocaust. Some of them do. Others try and prevent one, of course. The book is called Never. The strap line on the front cover reads, "The path to war begins with one false step." Ken Follett, thanks for joining us.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you. Are you wearing a tie? Because we talked to Stephen Fry about his new book, recently, Fry's Ties, but when I've seen you interviewed, you probably wear more nice ties than he does.
Yes, I've seen some of Stephen's ties, and I agree with you there.
I thought you might. And just before we talk about your new book, you told Lee Child in a conversation I was looking at that you think the greatest invention of the human race has been denied to us in recent times. And I found that interesting, and I thought, actually, that's probably right.
Yes, I've said that to Lee. I've said that more than once, that I think the restaurant is the greatest invention of the human race, because, look, you sit at a table talking to your friends and people bring you bottles of wine and plates of food. And, you know, that's what could be better than that? That's paradise. Unfortunately, as you say, we've been denied that. And we're allowed to go to restaurants in this country now. And Barbara and I go occasionally, but not very often, because we're still a bit nervous. How is it in New Zealand? Can you go to restaurants in New Zealand?
Well, you see, we're about to emerge blinking into that sunlight, but not quite. Well, in my part of New Zealand, in Auckland, not quite yet. Baby steps, Ken.
Right, yeah. Well, baby steps is probably the way to do it.
Before Never starts, come a couple of things worth asking you about, if I can. The Chinese proverb at the beginning of the book, two tigers cannot share the same mountain. So first question, there is an economic dominance mountain, isn't there, that the US and China are both trying to be on top of. But in terms of conflict over elbow room and so on, there is a big ocean between them. And you postulate war in Never and explain how it might happen. Do you think deep down in real life it could happen in the same sort of way?
Oh, yes, I absolutely believe that. From my study of the First World War, I'm convinced that it's possible to have a world war that nobody wants, nobody intends, just because events and slightly wrong decisions push you in that direction. And it happened in 1914, and I'm convinced that it could happen today. When I started work on the book, I developed this scenario and I asked various people, do you think this could really happen? And they all said, yes, it's possible. They didn't say it's going to happen. And obviously the people I was talking to were people who had dedicated, you know, part of their lives to preventing this kind of thing happening, but they all said, no, it's by no means impossible.
It's funny, you mentioned the First World War, which was the topic of the fall of giants, and the point is that no one wanted it, as you say, a ridiculous war kindled by vanities and daft alliances, which of course did not seem daft then. And I picked up Never to begin reading it a few minutes after I'd said to my son that no one wants war now. He was asking about the fragility of the world, and I said, not to bore you with the details, I said a big war is something no one wants. So I was in a mood to be spooked by your book, because you're saying that however informed and analytic our military and our politicians are now, we could still find ourselves in the big one, essentially. Human nature hasn't changed.
Well, I certainly think that, and no, I don't think human nature changes very much. And the particular part of human nature, I think, that's dangerous to us is the idea that we must appear strong. It's human nature Jim. I think it is human nature, but it's a side of human nature that's very dangerous and that we need to be more careful about. That's the aspect. So when all of the people in all of the major world leaders in my story in Never, the fictional world leaders, are trying to prevent this war, but they are all under pressure. The president of the United States is under pressure from a gung-ho, very right-wing, nationalistic rival. And in China, the president of China is under pressure from the old communists. We must not allow the West to humiliate us. People who are very emotional about these international conflicts. And that's the danger when, instead of being rational and calm, we get emotional and we start waving the flag. That's when we're in the most danger, I think.
And front and center in the First World War were those alliances that had to be honored. And here in this book, we have understandings and alliances that cannot be ignored, Ken.
Yes, that's right, of course. China, for example, has only one formal ally, which is North Korea. And the relationship between China and North Korea is a bit like our relationship with a rather disobedient teenage child, son or daughter, because the Chinese and North Koreans have an awful lot in common. North Korea is very important to China, but North Korea doesn't always do what China, like a wise parent, wants it to do. And so the relationship, although it's a strong relationship and an important alliance, it's actually fraught, as sometimes happens with our beloved teenage children.
I'm mindful of not giving away everything in the book, but you have central characters, as you say, trying to prevent overly emotional men causing a cataclysm, an American president who's a woman, and a woman also chasing the bad guys in the subplot. And you've got the head of South Korea, who is also a woman. Now, you resist the temptation to make all the female protagonists level-headed, but the inference is that the world might be safer with women in charge, different kinds of egos. Is that fair?
I think it's fair. My mum used to say this. Rest her soul, she used to say, if women ran the world, there would never be any wars. And while I don't quite believe that, I think there's a grain of truth in it. I do think that women are less likely to start a fight in a pub, and women who are the rulers of great countries are less likely to start a war than a man in the same position. It's just part of our natures. We men are a bit more belligerent, and women are a bit more calm and pacific. And so, yes, you're absolutely right. I made the president of the United States a woman because I wanted to underline that this is a person who's not seeking a war, who's not gung-ho and belligerent, who doesn't stand up and say, we're going to get those swine, but who says, we don't need to fight about this, let's work something out.
Mm. Do US presidents, speaking of Pauline Green, President Pauline Green, in your book, do they really carry around what you refer to as a biscuit?
Yes, that's absolutely true. It's called the biscuit. It's made of plastic. It's like a small wallet or purse, and inside is a card on which is written a code, a series of letters and numbers. And this is the code for starting a nuclear war. So if the president calls the war room at the Pentagon and says, this is the president, fire nuclear weapons at Beijing or Moscow or wherever, the person, the head of the armed forces will say, give me the code, please, Madam President. And she will read these letters and numbers off the card and they will press the nuclear button. Without that code, she's helpless. And presidents are supposed to carry that biscuit, that little plastic container, everywhere they go. And it must be on their bedside table when they go to sleep. If you think about it, there's got to be something like the biscuit, but in every country. But in the United States, it's that little plastic case.
Yeah, it doesn't bear too much thinking about, does it, when we consider the detail of all that and what it implies. Is there really a fallout shelter known colloquially as Munchkin country, at least you call it that, where the president and other chosen ones can survive for a long period of time?
Well, there is such a place. It probably isn't called Munchkin Country. I made that up. There is a place in the States called Cheyenne Mountain, which was at one time the refuge for the president in a time of nuclear war. And things have moved on, and there is now another refuge for the president. But of course, we don't know where it is because it's secret. But I based the details of Munchkin Country, you know, the fact that it's deep underground, the barracks, the fact that there's a hospital and a supermarket, the air cleaning equipment, all of that is based on what was at Cheyenne Mountain. So exactly the same exists somewhere else, exactly the same or possibly even more sophisticated.
By the way, from what you know about a full-on nuclear exchange, not that I'm necessarily saying there is one in your novel, where would you go, do you think, to try and survive it?
Do you know, I would have absolutely no faith at all that there was anywhere you could go to survive it, because if you don't get killed by the initial blast, you're probably going to be killed by radiation. And in the unlikely event that you survive that, they expect what would be what is called the nuclear winter, so that most places in the world can no longer grow crops. And so everybody starves. Hey, New Zealand's not a bad idea. A bit, it's going to take me so long to get there that I don't think I stand a chance. You guys might be all right, I suppose.
We probably think of that sometimes. You give us the stats regarding the nuclear weapons race between China and the US, and the US has always been ahead, but China could have 1,000 of them by 2030, we were told the other day, and probably smart ones too, not the old-fashioned ICBMs. Ken, logic suggests to you that at some point they'll be used, because in the last 70 years we've been living in their shadow and fretting underneath it, and tensions like that won't stay in abeyance forever. I get that impression from your book.
No, I don't believe that. I believe that human beings are smart enough to avoid nuclear war, but I don't think that's guaranteed. So I don't think it's inevitable at all. I think if we behave sensibly, we can avoid it. And of course, we have avoided it for 70 years. So there's some evidence to back up what I'm saying. But my point is, we are in danger. And I think we've got a little bit complacent about nuclear war, because we thought about it all the time in the 50s and 60s. And then there came a point in the 80s and 90s when we actually started to reduce the number of nuclear weapons, at least in Europe. And we all thought, okay, this is the beginning of a gradual improvement. There will be fewer and fewer nuclear weapons, and the danger will become smaller and smaller. And that didn't happen, did it? That's the tragic thing. The arms reduction program came to a halt, and now everybody is upping their nuclear armaments, and there are more and more countries that have nuclear arms. So I think that golden age in the 80s and 90s lulled us into something of a false sense of security. We stopped worrying so much about nuclear war, and I think we have to start worrying again.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point. Because at some point, Russia or China or the US or whomever might find advantage that they think makes it worthwhile. You know, a technology that intercepts incoming missiles, or we've seen talk about China's hyperglide missiles or stealth missiles. And if you could destroy the ability to retaliate, you know, ambition might overcome sense and humanity.
But as we know from the history of military technology, as soon as one side invents something, the other side invents something better. And this is clearly going to be a pattern. So I don't think we can put our hope in missile defense systems. They may well get better, but then countries will develop ways to evade the better systems. So it goes on and on, and I don't think there'll ever be 100% protection.
The book is never. We're talking to Ken Follett. What's interesting about it, well, lots of aspects, but the verisimilitude of all the conversations in Washington and Beijing as the tension in your book ratchets up, because they all know the stakes and they calculate how far they can push their interests. And on either side of the Pacific, they're accurately enough in one another's heads. And yet there are events, you know, like Franz Ferdinand deciding to get into that carriage that seem avoidable in hindsight. But again, they're just as likely today as they have been hitherto, Ken.
Yes, absolutely. You know, I talked to people at the top in international politics, but also my wife Barbara was a member of parliament for some years and a minister in Gordon Brown's government. And just by hanging out so much with politicians, and still a lot of our friends are in politics, and just by hanging out with those men and women and listening to them talk, you know, we, of course, having dinner at somebody's house or in a private room at a restaurant, they would talk about all sorts of things. You know, talk about our children and about music and theatre and all that kind of thing. But now and again, they would start talking about some political problem that the government had, and there would be an exchange about what should be done. And so I became very familiar with the way people in power discuss informally what they're going to do. And of course, anything they decided in that dinner table conversation would, the next day there would be a formal meeting and there would be a discussion with civil servants and the thing would be made official. But actually, quite often, the real decision was made rather quickly in that very frank, very informal discussion around a table. And so I got used to that. So I think I've got a fairly clear idea of how these things are really decided. And I'm very comfortable now, after all those years of hanging out with ministers and members of parliament, I'm kind of very familiar with these conversations. And so I assume that they're similar in Washington to the way they are in London. And I think they must be fairly similar in Beijing, in that there will be formal meetings where people will state formal positions and the real decisions will be made somewhere else when people say, now, honestly, what are we going to do about this?
Yeah. I wondered how many political insights came courtesy of your wife, Barbara. I think that's an assumption that many people make about you. The recipe for your secret sauce, as you call it, or as I've seen you call it, as a novelist, is on show here. This is the other aspect, as it was in Eye of the Needle all those years ago. Individuals on opposite sides of a divide who can change the course of history. And actually, even in this high-tech age, that could probably still happen. It certainly happened in World War II with Richard Sorge, the spy. He's a case example, isn't he? And it could still probably happen now that individuals can make a big difference.
I certainly think that you're right about that, because when I started writing thrillers all those decades ago, I realized that, of course, the spy and his enemy are fighting for their lives at some point, but there was something better than that, which is that they're also fighting for a cause, or they might be fighting for their country, or it might be for a revolution. I started to study history, looking for moments when the work of a spy could change the course of history or change the outcome of a battle or a revolution. If there are spies in a story, then what they're doing is not just about saving their own lives. It's about a higher purpose.
That's right. But Richard Sorge, for example, who was executed by the Japanese, he is a case example of how thankless it is being a great spy. You wonder why there have been so many.
A very good question. And at one stage, when I was writing Jackdaws is about a team who go into occupied France in the Second World War, and they're all women. And I studied the activities of the women, and there were, if I remember rightly, 50 women who went into occupied France as spies for the Allies. Most of them were caught by the Gestapo, and when they were caught, they were tortured for information, and then they were executed. These women knew. They knew that that was possible because, you know, it had been done to other people. Male spies had been caught. And so, and they, even though that was the fate that might await them, they said yes. And it baffles me how people have that much courage. How brave is that to go undercover, pretending to be something you're not, knowing that the Gestapo was looking for you and knowing what they'll do to you if they find. Wow. And that's, you know, that was what drove the book Jackdaws, because all those women were brave and smart and tough, but they all knew the fate that might await them. And, you know, I find it difficult to find words. I shouldn't say that, should I? I find it difficult to find words to express my admiration for that courage.
Yeah, no, you're right. It's a fascinating contemplation. And a couple of the famous ones had Kiwi connections. Nancy Wake, the White Mouse, and Phyllis Doyle. You know, they were those sorts of women too. So, no, we've often thought about that. I'm sure those of us who have read about their lives. All right, now your book. There is North Korea and the South China Sea where things get out of hand. And people must be asking you this. It was once the Balkans that was said to be the crucible of war. It is now most likely where you set this new book.
Yes, I think it's certainly very possible. North Africa could be the location of the original spark that starts the war. And of course, or leads towards the crisis that may end in war. And just like the assassination in Sarajevo in the Balkans, the repercussions then ping-pong to one country and another, Serbia to Austria, to Russia, to Germany, to France, to Britain. That's how it was in 1914. And something similar takes place in Never. The repercussions ping-pong. It starts in Africa, in a country called Chad, which is hardly even known to many people. And then, but then it ping-pongs. It ping-pongs to Washington and then to Beijing and to North Korea and Japan. And that's the way it goes. I must say, although I chose Africa, it could start in many other places. It could start in Iran, for example, the Strait of Hormuz. It could start in Kashmir, where the border between India and Pakistan, in the border between India and China. And of course, you guys know better than I, when you get to East Asia, you've got the problem of Taiwan and Hong Kong and the South China Sea. It's very difficult for the Communist Party, because the Communist Party thinks the only thing that really matters is control. And that has been a communist dogma right from the start. And so it's beginning to look as if they're willing to sacrifice prosperity for power. We just would like them to go back to normal business.
Okay, so there's that sense of manifest destiny in China that you say is getting greater. You know, your recent book, The Evening and the Morning, that was a great medieval time of change. And in Never, we are in real life on the brink of a tremendous change. So you've looked back and you've delved a lot into history with your books. You know, your scope is a whole millennium. So is there something that you feel in your waters that is special and perhaps perilous round about now?
Yes, I do think that. I do feel that the world is in more danger, or the human race is in more danger today than at any other time in my lifetime anyway, although I was born in 1949, so nuclear war has always been a threat in my life. I think it's more of a threat because more countries have nuclear weapons, and those that have nuclear weapons have more of them. And because China is an unpredictable rival to us, we don't know what they're going to do. And then, of course, we may all be wiped out by climate change or by a virus. So we've got all these things to contend with. And they are worse than before. You see, the viruses are more dangerous than before because we all travel so much. So all of these things are more dangerous in our very interlocked modern world than they used to be at the times of history that I've written about. I wrote with World Without End. My novel World Without End is about the Black Death, which was a pandemic and a very bad one. It killed between a third and a half of the population of Europe and North Africa and the Middle East, but it didn't spread any further than that. But if it happened again today, it would. So I do feel that the world is in a lot of danger now. And I suppose, perhaps unconsciously, that was what drove me to write Never, to write a novel about the threat to the human race.
Yeah. A couple of closing questions, if I can. Always being something else, sure, as a little boy. When you were small, you were a great game player, role player, I think. You had a strict upbringing and you escaped into your imagination. You lived there. Is that still the way, even now, that your brain kind of works?
Yes. Just as, you know, when I was 7 years old and I was always the, you know, pirate or a cowboy or an astronaut. Now, you know, I fantasize a lot now. A lot of the time, you know, when I'm not at my desk, sometimes just, you know, walking around or going to sleep, I sometimes think about my characters. I imagine other authors, like, I must ask people actually whether they have the same experience, but my guess would be that other authors would say yes, that's how I am, because I don't think you can be an author, at least I don't think you can write novels unless you do have that kind of imagination. It's a gift. And it's been a great blessing to me.
In novels like the ones you write, you've said you need between 50 and 100 dramatic episodes, which I found interesting, even though, you know, you think about it and you think, oh, that makes sense. Is that plotted out, Ken, or do they just happen by instinct as you go? The drama writes itself, or how does it work?
I plot everything in advance. I'm a great planner. I spend my normal schedule is 3 years to write a long novel, and the first year is research and planning, and I find I have to do that planning. Now, my friend Lee Child is the opposite to me. He sits down and he types chapter one, and then he thinks, okay, what shall this book be about? And I can't work that way. When I began trying to write novels, I didn't plan. And my early novels were unsuccessful. They were published, but they were not bestsellers. And my first success, Eye of the Needle, was also the first novel that I planned and researched. And I realized that this was the way for me. It's not the way for every novelist by any means, but it is the way for me.
Yes, Lee Child told us about his writing technique, closing his eyes and lying on the couch. But unlike Lee Child, you span genres. Now, I'm just curious, what genre has sold the most books for you, you know, book by book, out of interest? What are people most interested in?
Certainly in terms of sale, the books of mine that have sold the most have been the Kingsbridge novels, starting with The Pillars of the Earth, which I must say, although when I had finished it, I thought I had written something pretty special. I never expected this. And it has sold something like 27 million copies. And it still sells. It's still selling. It's been out for 32 years now. And people are still buying it. And they're still sending me messages and posting on social media how much they love the book. So that is completely astonishing. So that's the genre in which I have sold most copies so far. But I haven't finished yet.
No.
It may change again.
Ken Follett has been our guest, and we've been talking about his book, Never. Lovely of you to have a chat.
Enjoyed it very much, Jim. Thanks very much for having me on the show.